This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. In today's program, we consider two important elections that took place over the weekend. We'll be looking at the election in Greece, where there was a showdown between austerity forces and those who are concerned about the economic stability of the European community. We'll be speaking live with Dr. Richard Wolff about that and many other things in today's program. Also, there was an election in Egypt in which there were candidates brought forward under the aegis of the Supreme Military Council, which announced new rules for the constitution and for the transfer of power in what is perhaps erroneously being called the post-Mubarak regime. We'll be joined live by the editor-in-chief of the Middle East Research and Information Project, Chris Tunsing. All of that and more coming up on today's 5 o'clock shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we take a look today at the recent election in Egypt as well as the one that took place over the weekend in Greece. And we are now joined live by Dr. Richard Wolff. He is an economist. He is a professor at Amherst at the University of Massachusetts and a visiting professor in the graduate program of the New School in New York City, and the author most recently of the new book, Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism. And I'm so happy to welcome you live this first time to 5 o'clock shadow, Dr. Wolff, as well as welcoming you back to the United States from your recent travels in France and in Paris, where I presume during your lectures there that you had the attentive ear of the new French President Hollande, n'est-ce pas?
I wish it were the case. Thank you very much for inviting me. I hope maybe somehow what the things that were that I said might have found their way at least to some of his advisors. Who knows?
We begin with what has been a battle you've been watching and analyzing for quite some time, the question of Greek austerity, bailouts, and the input of the bankers and nations of the European community. Can you tell us the significance and consequences of the Greek elections over this weekend?
Yes, they really are enormous, these consequences. Just to make sure everybody's on the same page, the Greeks went to the polls to basically elect their parliament and to see who's going to be the new government. For many, many decades, government has been a game of musical chairs in Greece, in which the New Democracy and the Socialist Party take turns being the leaders of Greece, a little bit like Republicans and Democrats here in the United States. And the first and most important thing about the election that happened yesterday, like the one that happened a month earlier, is that the two parties combined that used to run the country are now barely able to get 40% of the vote. But it's very important that people understand that the Greek political system has fundamentally altered basically in the last 6 to 12 months. And what has happened is that the Greek people have basically had it up to here. They are upset and angry about being in the fifth year of the crisis of capitalism that they're living through. They are, secondly, deeply upset that the bailouts, the help that the government provided, went only to banks, financial companies, large corporations. And finally, that the expensive cost of bailouts that they never benefited from are now supposed to be paid for by them, namely in the form of foregoing government jobs, government pensions, government pay, to free up the money to pay off the debts for a bailout that didn't help them. This is simply too much to tolerate, and they have basically declared no business as usual in the Greek sense. And so they've basically handed both of the big parties a minority position in Greek politics at the expense, overwhelmingly, of a very far left-wing political party, Syriza, relatively new on the scene, but able to capture a huge proportion of the young people in Greece, which is a sign of where things are going politically, but basically a political party that not only opposes austerity up and down the line, but rejects the bailouts that happened, rejects the conditions of Europe's help to Greece as being damaging to Greece and no help at all. And finally, and this is perhaps the most important thing, is willing to say openly and loudly that the problem here is not just austerity and bailouts and this and that policy or politician, but that there's a system that isn't working called capitalism, and they don't shy away from saying that. For an enormous new electorate in Greece to embrace that kind of politics, that kind of thinking, that's what's the momentous change signaled by the election yesterday. And so it was really misleading in the most basic sense when newspapers, including the front page of today's New York Times, could see no further than a 3 percentage point difference between the New Democracy Party and the Syriza left-wing party. What's remarkable about that is how little the difference was and what a stunning victory for Syriza's growth it all represented.
There was also the matter of, I believe, a 7% vote for a neo-fascist party in the Greek elections. Is that of any useful significance? And I would follow on with whether that political tendency increases in times of economic strife.
Right. Well, you put your finger right on it. That is what happens. That is what's happening in Greece. And it's not hard to understand. It happens wherever economic times are really hard. Indeed, it's a kind of an evidence, if you like, or a marker or a sign that things are really deteriorating. And here's the way it works in Greece and, in my judgment, in most other countries. When suddenly large numbers of people lose their jobs or lower their incomes or lose all kinds of benefits that they and their families had counted on, they get upset. When it lasts a long time, they get more upset. And when it looks to be deteriorating rather than getting fixed by the government or by business, then they get still more upset. Some of them, and fortunately that's the vast majority in Greece, decide to become social critics of one kind or another, to question capitalism, to question the status quo and the old politicians. That's all to the good and long overdue. But you always also have another reaction. The best way to describe it is this way. You look for scapegoats. Your situation is deteriorating. You're upset. You're angry. No one ever helped you see or foresee this. So now you look for the bad person, the bad forces that brought it. And we always have the same candidates. It's this or that ethnic minority. It's this or that religious minority. It's immigrants. It's, you know, you pick. And the right wing always sees this as an opportunity to win converts by being the first and loudest in pinpointing the scapegoats. So, for example, in Greece, the New Dawn Party that you're referring to, that got 6 or 7% of the vote, has decided to cash in on the Greek upset with immigrants. There's a large flow of immigrants, particularly from the East, some from Africa, but some from Eastern Europe. They're poor. They come with next to nothing. They try to find a life in Greece. And when times are good, they're welcomed as inexpensive workers. And when times are hard, they are denounced as the scapegoat, as if these poor people arriving in the country were the problem. It isn't. And if you threw all the immigrants out, for example, it would not make a fundamental difference in the dilemma of Greek society. But in people's upset and anger, scapegoating is something you're going to see, and that's what that party is cashing in on.
With the economic condition of Greece, what is the blowback to the European Union? They're speaking of possibly leaving the euro as a unit of currency. What is the reaction to this in the rest of the European Union? And can you distinguish between the behavior and interests of the banks versus the populations?
Sure. All of Europe was transfixed by the Greek development. And the reason is very simple. Every single European country is going through one or another kind of austerity. Now, in places like Scandinavia and Germany, the austerity is quite mild, but it's there. In places like Ireland or Portugal or Spain or Italy or Hungary, it is very severe and having enormous negative economic and social impact. So seeing in one country, this case Greece, a strong new anti-capitalist political force arise and do stunningly well in a very short number of years is a warning sign for all conventional politicians across Europe. They are all smart enough to know that if it can happen in Greece, then the question isn't so far behind in the minds of its own people, who will also be reading the results of the Greek political shifts. So yes, it impacts everywhere. It changes the balance of forces in every European country away from the predominance of those who keep saying austerity, 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 and much more toward those who say no austerity. The government should be helping the mass of people, hiring more, not fewer, improving benefits, not cutting them, and so on, and taxing wealthy people. Indeed, the very program that won so decisively in the French elections yesterday. And so I think the Greek election is very bad news for the bankers and for the politicians that they have mostly controlled through the first 5 years of this crisis. So they're now looking at a situation when it'll be much harder for them to get another bailout, as many of them are counting on. It'll be much harder to make sure that government policy tilts toward existing large banks and financiers in the way that it has in the first 5 years. So again, I would underscore that even though Greece is a very small country on the periphery of Europe, it is a kind of laboratory in which the shifts we see there are very good signs of the shifting pressures everywhere else.
Dr. Wolf, there is the prospect that the anti-austerity movement in Greece may not have performed its final act, and the prospect of Greece withdrawing from the European Union or dropping the euro. Can you tell us why that worries people, what that means, and what the consequences would be for the Greek people?
Yes, I think that you have to distinguish the reality from the political hype that has been made inside Greece and in Europe, and that was basically picked up uncritically by most of the mainstream media here in the United States. So first, the hype. In order to get the Greek people, who are overwhelmingly angry and opposed to the austerity that has hurt them so badly, in order to get them to vote in favor of continuing the austerity they hate, you really have no option if you are a conservative of that new democracy party. You had no option other than terror. You terrified, you alarmed the Greek people by painting as dark and foreboding a picture of what would happen if they voted the way they wanted to for Syriza against austerity. So that's what they did. They kept saying, if you vote for Syriza, it means Greece is all alone. It quits or is thrown out of the European Union. It quits or is thrown out of the euro. And how in the world can we survive as a small, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Syriza is not in favor of leaving the European Union. And Syriza is not in favor of leaving the euro. That was just an election kind of ploy. What Syriza and the Greek left keep saying is that the question is, what kind of European Union, favoring whom? Is it going to be a union that preserves capitalism at all costs, even when the mass of people are made to suffer and pay for policies that didn't help them? Or is it going to be a union focused on helping people? Is it for capital? Is it for labor? Is it a union designed to aid big bankers? Or is it a union designed to help the average person? That, for the Greek left, was the issue, not entering or leaving the European Union. Having said that, it is, of course, also true that if the new democracy that won the election does, in fact, as it sometimes says it is going to, continue to live by the bailout agreements, which means to impose new austerity on top of the old austerity in Greece, you're going to see an explosive situation. To answer the first part of your question, Syriza will continue its anti-austerity politics. It will win more people as they see what it means to have voted out of panic for the new democracy. And the situation in Greece will turn very troubled, to be as nice about it as I can. And much here is at stake. Under some circumstances, would the left in Greece begin to argue that staying in a union that is so tilted against the mass of people is worse than taking your chances to step outside? The answer is yes, that would be a consideration. But that is in the future, and that depends more on how Europe evolves over the next year or two than it does on some abstract commitment to one of these ideas on the part of the Greek left.
Our guest is Dr. Richard Wolff. He's the author of Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism. He's a professor of economics both at Amherst and the New School in New York City. And Dr. Wolff, there was also another election, and I realize that you have just returned recently from France. What is the significance of the over-the-weekend activity in France?
Well, again, I was struck that the newspapers and that I saw this morning in the United States were full of the Greek election, but not the French election. Strange to me. Greece is a much smaller country than France. France's imprint in terms of its shaping of what happens in Europe is enormous. And the events in France, in their way, are as dramatic as those in Greece, although a little different. Let me explain. For the first time in at least half a century, and it may be much longer than that, I'm just no expert on French history, but in at least a half century, we've never before seen the French Socialist Party be in complete control of the government. The president now is a member of the French Socialist Party. The upper house of the parliament, the Senate, is controlled by the socialists. They have a clear majority. And yesterday, the socialists won a very clear majority in the lower house of parliament, the National Assembly. As a result, the socialists have a complete monopoly on all the major levers of power in France. They are committed against austerity. They are committed to raise corporate taxes, to raise taxes on rich people from 45 to 75%, and to immediately hire 40,000 more teachers across France, and indeed to provide more help to the average person, to hire more people, to provide more jobs, and so on. They're going to now be the test case. They have all the power they need. Will they deliver on the promises to end the austerity program in France and to make big business and the rich pay for that, or will they not? If they don't, they will follow what happened to the Socialist Party of Greece, which probably set back the reputation and the prospects for the Socialist Party in Greece for decades to come by imposing austerity, by reneging on its promise when it was elected in 2009. If the same thing is now played out by the French socialists, they will discover a Syriza party of their own in France to take all their thunder away, the way the Syriza party took away the thunder of the Greek socialists. And indeed, that party is already there in France. It's called the Front de Gauche, which means the left front party. They will have 10 or 11 seats in the new French parliament. They are a part of French politics. They did very well. They're also a new party like Syriza, and they are again a sign of a growing determination not only to oppose austerity, but to begin finally questioning the capitalist system that brings all of this to the popular experience at such enormous social costs.
Do the policies of war contribute significantly to the economic stress of France and the other nations of Europe, much less the United States?
Not as much as the United States, for sure. But in their way, they all struggle with peculiar, unresolved military apparatuses that the politicians dare not confront. The French, for example, maintain a nuclear arsenal, and the only question anyone could ever ask is, whatever for? Who are you going to fight with that? The French could never go to war by themselves. They'd be obliterated in 10 minutes. The whole idea of maintaining a nuclear force, it almost seems as though it's a kind of a status symbol in the world, trying to hold on to some global importance as the actual reality of France in the world economy keeps shrinking. In the case of Greece, they have their endless real, half fantasy struggles with Turkey, their long nemesis. So they maintain a major military burden. And yes, in times of difficulty, which are extreme in Greece, the money wasted or spent, if you like, on military capability and a military force is always a burden that the country would be much better off without. You see that in England as well. You see it everywhere. The United States is, of course, a much bigger military force and is global in its stretch. None of the other European countries can even dream of that, let alone do it. And indeed, England and Europe have gotten away with quite a bit over the years because they are under the military protection, in a sense, of the United States. But they, of course, are very upset about it because they are asked to support the United States in exchange for not having to spend even more on military because they can kind of hide under the American umbrella. As it becomes more difficult in the United States to cover our military expenses, we want to put pressure on the Europeans. And if that continues, there's going to be tension with the Europeans of a sort we haven't seen for a long time.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York with Dr. Richard Wolff, the economist. And to bring the discussion closer to home, or at least to the hemisphere, earlier today at an economic summit in Mexico, President Obama said that he was encouraged by the Greek vote. Is he whistling in the dark? And how do American economic policies and bailouts and austerities factor into the global interrelationship?
Well, Mr. Obama and his advisors are basically walking a tightrope and trying to talk out of both sides of their mouths at the same time. Here's the truth. The United States economy, Mr. Obama assured us from last November until April of this year, was in a quote-unquote recovery. He really associated himself and his reelection campaign with that recovery. That recovery has now sputtered out of gas. We haven't been recovering for the last 2 months, and it doesn't look like we're going to be doing it for the rest of the year, that is, right up until the election. Therefore, that was a very dangerous move on his part because he risks being stuck with the blame for a recovery that never happened, and he might have rethought that policy. But in any case, he wants the best possible economic conditions going into the election this fall. For that, he needs American companies to have brisk sales in Europe. Europe is a major buyer of American exports. Europe is also a major investor inside the United States, setting up factories, opening jobs, setting up offices, and so on. A healthy Europe, one that buys a lot of American products and invests money here, will be good for Mr. Obama's reelection. So what he really wants to say but doesn't dare is that he's not at all upset that the Greeks are moving to the left and demanding an end to austerity, and that the French are doing likewise, because the stimulus they may give to the forces in Europe that want to spend money and build the economy and grow rather than have them cut back austerity, that's good for American business over there and selling to the Europeans. The reason he can't say it explicitly, and the reason why today he had to quote-unquote welcome the results in Greece, is because the people who are pushing for an end to austerity in Europe are all called socialists, communists, Marxists, and so on. And poor Mr. Obama doesn't know how to present himself to the American people in a way that could explain his positions without risking that the Republicans will have a field day by associating him with socialists and communists. So he has to kind of back his way into a support for a change in policy in Europe, not because he really disagrees with austerity, but because austerity in Europe would be bad for the American economy in the next 6 months, and that's bad for his re-election opportunity.
With Obama in Mexico, it brings naturally to mind the history of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and the Caribbean base initiative of prior years. And now the United States is involved in an oddly non-Sino-Asian trade regime. How do these policies affect the health of the economy and the resistance to austerity?
Well, I think that the whole NAFTA story is a major tragedy of our time, and it would take a long time to go through all of it. Suffice it to say that there is no way that we can, in the United States at this point, salvage our southern neighbor. The conditions in Mexico keep deteriorating. They keep becoming intolerable. Large portions of Mexico are a failed state, a failed economy. Let me put it this way. During the boom in the United States from 2000 to 2007, huge numbers of Mexicans came to the United States, Central Americans, and were able to find work in the housing industry and elsewhere. And not only did that solve the unemployment problem for Mexico, but it brought cheap labor to the United States, which fueled our boom. And part of the money that the Mexican workers, who worked very hard and very long, part of what they did with their money was to send it back to their families in Mexico. So Mexico was able to export its unemployed, good for its economy, and bring huge amounts of remittances, they're called, money payments, back from Mexicans working hard here in the United States, a big plus for their economy as well. But now all of that is reversed. The crisis here in the United States, 5 years old, the terrible impact it has had on the housing industry has unemployed millions of Mexican workers who had those jobs. They do not qualify for welfare, for unemployment insurance, because many of them are illegal, and they have to effectively go back to a Mexico that doesn't have jobs for them, and to a Mexico that is now in trouble because since they're not working in the United States, they can't send back the remittances either. And so the United States, in a sense, dumps its unemployed immigrant workers back into the countries from which they came, who cannot handle them, and who therefore dissolve in a kind of chaos of crime and drugs and warfare and gangs, side by side with a increasingly smaller, well-off portion of the Mexican population. And lest Americans think, oh, that's just their problem. Please remember, that's our major neighbor to the south. If they can't function as a society, if they are increasingly caught up in more and more trouble, as they are, that all impacts the area closest to the border and to the rest of our society. And I think that we are very short-sighted in not wanting to face that the economic crisis in the United States hurts us all in direct ways. Unemployment, home foreclosure, and all the rest, but also in countless secondary or indirect ways, as when the story I just told about our Mexican workers having to go back into a society that has no place for them, and what the social and political upheaval that's going to cause as it ramifies back here in the United States. It's a little bit like what I said about Europe. We have a lively trade with Mexico, but that can fall apart if the Mexican society doesn't hold together, which is what is now happening. And after a while, if our European connection is not working well, and if our Mexican connection isn't working well, the idea that the United States can somehow escape the economic consequences of all of these dysfunctions of a global capitalist system is very, very naive and will come to grief.
Well, Dr. Wolf, I think we're very grateful for the economic world tour upon which you have taken us today. And I commend to our listeners' attention your latest book with David Barsamian, Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism. And more information on that is available at your website, rdwolf.com.
Right.
And congratulations on your success with our sibling program that you do on Saturdays on WBAI called Economic Update.
Yes, it's been a wonderful experience of learning how to present the realities of an economic system in a lot of trouble to an audience that really wants to hear and wants to learn and wants to talk about it, and only asks of those of us who do this as a profession that we make it clear and understandable. And you know, the basic ideas of economics always were simple and clear and understandable. And you don't need an economist, and most of them, they're my colleagues after all, are not useful because they never learned how to talk and explain things. And after all, that's the major job we have as professionals. So it's a wonderful opportunity, the program, as WBAI is an exceptional station to make all this kind of programming possible.
Well said, Rick. Thank you so much for being on The Shadow today.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. We'll be back with more after this.
Come on, everybody sing. It don't worry me. It don't worry me. You may say I ain't free. It don't worry me. Everybody. Don't worry me. It don't. Every song, it don't work. Tax relief may never come. It don't worry me. Economy's depressed.
Come on, I need you. Come on.
My spirit's high as they can be. You may say I ain't free. It don't worry me. Oh. It don't worry me. It don't worry me. You might say it. It don't worry me. Oh, it don't worry me. It don't worry me. You may say it. It don't. Worry me.
the inimitable Barbara Harris performing It Don't Worry Me from Robert Altman's Nashville. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we're now joined live by Chris Tunsing, the editor-in-chief of the Middle East Research and Information Project. And we're here on a day after the latest twist and turn of elections in Egypt, which may or may not have to do with the real democratic impulse. And there was a runoff over the weekend, Chris. What results do we have so far?
Well, the results are still untallied completely. Both candidates, actually, in the runoff are claiming victory. Both the Ahmed Shafiq, who was Hosni Mubarak's last vice president and is associated very closely with the old deposed regime, and then Mohamed Morsi, who is the candidate of the Muslim Brothers. Morsi is ahead right now in the tally that's been released, but Shafiq has challenged that, and there are some 3 million votes yet to be tallied, so the final result is not going to be announced until Wednesday or Thursday.
There is the perplexity of the possibility that whoever shall be named president will be appointed to a position of insignificant power for more than one reason. Certainly the Supreme Armed Forces Command has intervened in terms of the Constitution writing. How real an exercise in democracy do you assess this to be, given the overshadowing of the military and perhaps the cultural continuity of the Mubarak epic?
Well, I think the events of the weekend have been nothing less than a full-fledged military coup that have completely robbed the Egyptian uprising of 2011 of its democratic and emancipatory promise. The final action of the Egyptian junta to which you just referred, the so-called Constitutional Declaration of Sunday, essentially put the junta above any elected or other branch of the Egyptian government. It, for instance, required the future Egyptian president to consult it before declaring war. So it's taking all of the powers that ought to be vested in civilian government and placing them in the hands of the military indefinitely. And there's no, although the military is making the requisite noises about transferring powers to a civilian government as soon as possible, to please Washington, of course, the declaration that the junta made on Sunday makes it clear that for the foreseeable future, all meaningful powers of governance will be vested in itself. And it's something of a surprise to Egyptians and also to observers of Egypt, who we, and including myself, who had assumed that the military's game was to rule Egypt without governing it, that to borrow the phrase of Stephen Cook of the Council of Foreign Relations, that is to sort of remain in the shadows, but to allow a civilian face to carry out the actual tasks of government. But it appears that the junta wants to exercise a much more visible role.
I'd like to take a closer look at the role of each of those who were selected to be the two final runoff candidacies. And let's begin with the Muslim Brothers or the Muslim Brotherhood. Is it really true that the leadership is that distant from the military establishment?
That's an open question. Certainly, the Muslim Brothers as an organization have a long history of sort of shadow boxing with the regime in power at the time. They are officially outlawed, of course, and they have endured a lot of repression and imprisonment and physical violence at the hands of the various regimes that have ruled Egypt in the past 50 years. At the same time, the Muslim Brothers have collaborated with the regimes on numerous occasions to smash the left in the 70s, to smash other sorts of challenges to regime power in subsequent decades. And a lot of Egyptians believe, and you know, with some justification, I think, that the Muslim Brothers have sort of been under the table, have been playing footsie with the Supreme Council and the armed forces over the course of this past year. And if Morsi does in fact, if he is in fact awarded the presidency by the final tally of the votes later this week, there is some question about whether the brothers would take an appropriately confrontational stance toward what the junta has done over the weekend. Certainly, right now, they're making all the right noises. They're saying that they do not recognize the decision by the Constitutional Court to dissolve the Egyptian parliament, in which they had a majority. They're saying that they do not recognize the junta's plan to issue its own constitution, and that they intend to proceed with the pre-existing plans to draft a constitution by a committee elected by the parliament, and so on. But, you know, the proof is in the pudding. We'll see. And certainly a lot of Egyptians are suspicious of what the brothers are really all about.
Our guest is Chris Tensing, the editor-in-chief of the Middle East Research and Information Project. And here now comes a difficult question for, I think, for all of us around the world who have watched recent events in Egypt and similar places. During the election, I'm told that supporters of the so-called April 6th movement were telling each other to vote for the Muslim Brother as opposed to having a continuity of the Mubarakian leadership in Egypt and the presidency of Mr. Shafiq. Now, my question is this. Has there been a miscalculation on the part of brave people, brave and creative people, who spent a few weeks in Tahrir Square in Cairo, and who may have assumed that an internet revolution was a revolution, and thereby quit the agitation, allowed a military design to process to come forward, and now are surprised to see that the military remains triumphant in Egypt. Does this mean that the concept of a State Department-aided internet revolution is not a sufficient condition for real democracy and change?
Well, I guess I have to say that on balance, no, I don't think that's fair to the people who occupied Tahrir Square in 2011. For one thing, I don't think that they received significant aid of any kind from the State Department. This was a wholly indigenous.
At Columbia University.
I'm sorry?
At Columbia University, the Alliance for Youth Movements.
The alliance between the April 6th movement and people at Columbia University?
Yes, many of the people who turned up prominent in the internet revolution in Egypt had been trained and assisted by the Alliance for Youth Movements, which was a State Department-assisted operation along with Freedom House.
Well, you know, those links I'm sure existed, and there were also, you know, some minor links with Otpor, the Serbian movement, but I think that those were comparatively insignificant.
You know, I agree with you. I'm not saying that the people who were in Tahrir Square, I referred to them as courageous and principled, the people who faced, you know, violence and suppression and arrest and military treatment. But I'm just saying, for those of us here in the United States and in other parts of the world who thought that that moment was really a transformational one, when it appears not to have been, given the state of Egypt today. So my question is, what went wrong?
Well, I do think that the moment was transformational, in the sense that prior to the uprising of 2011, although Egypt was not static politically, it was not stagnant. I don't mean to imply that it was, but there was kind of an overwhelming sense of fear and despair about the prospect of meaningful political change. And what the uprising in Tunisia did was break the wall of fear, and what the uprising in Egypt did was dispel the regional despair that attended not just the Mubarak regime, but also the regimes of all of the other autocratic rulers across the Arab world. And I think that that spirit has lived on despite all of these defeats in many ways. You can see it in the continued activism of the youthful revolutionaries, middle-class activists. You can also see it in ongoing worker actions, strikes, and so on, which have persisted despite the attempt of the Egyptian junta to outlaw those and make them punishable by quite severe penalties. So that sort of spirit of a society being in upheaval has continued. It's correct that that spirit has not coalesced in the kind of unified pan-societal movement that would be required to achieve a true social revolution in Egypt. That's correct. And it remains to be seen whether, the dispiriting events of the last few months and the very dispiriting events of the last few days are going to sort of provoke that sort of social revolution. But I do think that kind of in awe of what the Egyptians achieved in 2011. I don't think that should be taken away from them, despite the fact that there has clearly been, a conspiracy, really, of the military and other forces in Egypt to reverse the achievements of 2011. I think the final chapter has yet to be written.
Well, if the military remains pretty much in charge, as you said earlier, having conducted a de facto coup, how do these energies get refocused, rechanneled, and deepened in order to change the condition of military leadership in Egypt and United States funding and geostrategic interests? How does such an honorable movement become more effective?
Well, I don't know, and that's a question for Egyptians to answer, and I know that a lot of Egyptian activists are thinking about that right now. Though, of course, these things will take time, and I think one also can't underestimate the degree to which Egyptian activists are exhausted by, a full year and counting now of periodic occupations of Tahrir Square, periodic million-person marches in downtown Cairo, and a host of smaller actions in towns and provinces around the country. So it's going to take time, and I'm sure there's a lot of demoralization now. But I do think that it's going to be very difficult because of the breaking of the wall of fear and the breaking of the wall of despair last year. It's going to be difficult for the junta and its affiliated civilian politicians to return Egypt to the way it was under Hosni Mubarak. And I do think that any successor government, no matter how military-dominated it is going to have to be much more sensitive than Mubarak was, both to the demands of the population for a more open political system, though I'm sure that, we're not going to be talking about a Jeffersonian democracy. There may be positive movement away from what Mubarak was presiding over. And perhaps even more so, I think that successor government will have to be more responsive to the economic demands, the demands for economic justice coming from the population, for the quite simple reason that they're going to want to reestablish stability as soon as they can, and the society remains in a great deal of upheaval and ferment.
Well, so might it be. I thank you so much for a very informative and engaging discussion today. We've been speaking with Chris Tunzing, the editor of the Middle East Research and Information Project, and I've long admired your institution and find it a very informative resource. How can people be in touch?
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Our website is merip.org, MERIP, as in Paul, .org.
We'll keep up the good work, and thank you, Chris. Chris
Tunzing
of Merip.
The world is waking outside my window. Bella Chow, Bella Chow, Bella Chow, 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 drags my senses into the sunlight, for there are things that I must do. Wish me luck now, I have to leave you. Bella Chow, Bella Chow, Bella Chow, 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 with my friends now up to the city. We're gonna shake the gates of hell, and I will tell them, we will tell them,
Bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. That our sunlight is not for franchise, and wish the bastards drop down dead.
Next time you see me, I may be smiling.
Bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. I'll be in prison or on the TV. I'll say the sunlight dragged me here. Questa mattina mi son svegliato. Oh, bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. Today's program produced with Thiago Barroso and engineered by Michael G. Haskins. We welcome your comments at theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.